since I've been here, we've covered a number of topics, including history. We've covered a number of things, including the book of Revelation. We walked through the minor prophets this last semester. And this semester, we're going to walk through the Apostles' Creed. And we're going to do that because one of the things that I was reminded of as I was talking with a friend of mine who's a theologian is that you can never forget the importance of walking through those elementary things of the faith, those foundational things of the faith, and being able to do that. So this semester, as you'll see on the sort of the quasi-syllabus that we hand out, it is this idea, the title for this semester is Creed, Walking Through the Apostles' Creed. We're going to be going and spending our time walking through and talking about what it is to believe. What are those basic intrinsic things to Christianity? What are those things that since the creed came around that the church has believed? And we'll look a little bit historically. We'll look and see how did this thing come about and what does it mean? We're going to look biblically. What are the grounding? What are the roots for this? We're also going to look and see how those things matter to us today, theologically, and as well as application, to see what we can, how we believe and what we're about. So we're looking forward to getting into our spring study for our pastor's Bible study. And this is, this topic of the Apostles' Creed is indeed what we are going to be going through. So you'll see that we've got this kind of laid out pretty simply in this document. Just sort of talking synopsis-wise, you'll see this in printed stuff around the church as well as online, that we have a rich heritage of faith that's been developed over the centuries. You know, one of the things that's really intriguing about the three different monotheistic religions, and the three different monotheistic religions, Christianity being one of them, what are the other two? Judaism and Islam, yeah. They all have three specific interests. Islam is about rigor, it's about routine. You go to the seven pillars, what you do during the day, the different prayers that you offer. It's about a religion that is a rigorous one. You go to Judaism, it has an ethnic identity to it. And Christianity, it's been said that one of the things that makes Christianity so powerful, is again, this is the powerful traits of it, is that dogmatically it is theologically one of the most tightly structured belief systems. We believe things that are held significantly, and we shouldn't forget that. It's extremely encouraging and what we have going on there. So you'll see a little bit about the synopsis. You can read a little bit over that in a few moments, but you'll notice we have the schedule on there. This is the spring schedule for our pastor's Bible study. We've included in there Ash Wednesday, which is Valentine's Day. So you can come here and be spreaded with ash and then go on a date, and that'll be good. On February 14th, we'll be out for that week, but then also March 14th, we will be on spring break in CCISD, and so we will not have class that week. We will make it all the way through the beginning of May with this study. And what we've done is we've taken the Apostles' Creed, which generally is a number of stanzas, a set number of stanzas, and we've kind of broken them up into individual study units. Try to talk about it, you know, in terms of phrases. Now, we could have really extended this thing and looked at the bits and pieces and gotten to 19 weeks or 20 weeks, I think is where I ended up. Hey, if I really broke all these out to their major essential parts. But what we wanted to do is be a little bit more expedient and not make it to August. So we broke these into some real simple phrases in the Apostles' Creed. What we're going to do is each week, and I'll have plenty of these. I'll keep the ones that I printed off this week, and we'll have them for next week and so forth. We'll also probably put this schedule up online because it's really easy to put up there. We'll have some corresponding chapters in the book that we're going to be covering, but we're just going to sort of handle this thing. We're going to tackle it phrase by phrase. We're going to deal with maybe a couple significant concepts. So, for instance, next week, we're going to start with, I believe in God the Father Almighty. What does it mean to say that I believe? What does it mean to say I believe in God? What does it mean that God is Father? And what does it mean that the Father is Almighty? Kind of breaking into that, sort of talking about what that looks like. And that's sort of how we're going to be handling getting into and talking about the Apostles' Creed, sort of phrasastically, going to working through that. So you can see the schedule that we'll have. As I mentioned, we'll get that up on the internet for you guys. And as we do every semester, we always try to have a good book that you guys can dig into. I know we've had some Last semester's, I got to tell you, last semester's book I thought was just great, just because it's just one of those unique books that you find that really slots in well with what we were going to cover. And it was that prophet's book by, was it McCullough or Kavanaugh? What's that?
McConville.
I was getting close. There was a Mick in there, there was a Con in there, and I was getting close. But thank you, yes. I thought that was a great, really interesting how these things dovetail in. And we actually, after looking at first some of these, we found a couple that are kind of idiosyncratic. The problem with a lot of good academic texts that appeal to Dr. Laufer and myself, they have a tendency to be plus $50. And we find that to be a threshold most people don't want to cross for a book. So we went another route, and we were able to, as we looked through and began digging through some materials, because we just kept not finding the stuff that we wanted, we came across a book by J.I. Packer. And it is a tiny little book. It has a great component to it because it's doing exactly what we're going to be doing with this class, is walking through the Apostles' Creed phrase by phrase. And he gives you a biblical study, he gives you a devotional thought, and then he has reflective questions within each of the the paragraphs. He gives an idea of what that phrase means, gives a bit of its historical context, explains a few things, and gives you some options for some additional study. In each page, I mean, this is like a tiny little book. Each page is only probably about 4 or 5 pages long, or each chapter is only about 4 or 5 pages long. And they did a really good job on laying this out. And we found the book, and I contacted the publisher. As I found last semester, is often a better route than going to some of your major distributors. So we're going to be able to sell the book for $5 a piece, which I think is a pretty good deal, because we got these. They usually retail this thing for $11.99, but we're going to be able to move that. So I got a bunch of them. I will tell you this: I'm only going to be selling about 25 of these, because that's about as many as I got. And then y'all are on your own. So if you're here tonight, you have an opportunity to be one of the select few that's able to pay. Now, they also have this in Kindle. They got it on the Nook. They got it on EPUB. They've got it on all the other stuff if you want to give it like that, too. I'm actually a big fan of digital stuff because I'm moving my entire library to the digital if I can, just because it's a whole lot easier to carry a 10,000-volume library on your computer than it is to carry a 10,000-volume library. So anyways, that's some thoughts for you. That's kind of what we wanted to sort of step through with that. This is the book, sort of this idea of J.I. Packer's Affirming the Apostles' Creed. And I think you'll be encouraged by this. I'd love some feedback. I always love feedback about the book that we're able to find for you guys. It'll be over here, and I'll be over here afterwards. I've got a cash box with some stuff in it. If you want to write a check, you can do that. If you have a credit card, I'll take it and use it for the week, but then I'll have a little swiper next week due to the weather event that we experienced. We've had not everybody was able to get around, and I wasn't able to find the little doodad that we swipe credit cards with. So anyways, we'll have that for next week as well. Yes, that's why we got the cash box, and I'll take $5 cash, absolutely. Or if you want to give me more and consider it a tip, I'm not declaring it on my taxes. So, but you can do that as well. I will not say no to tips, other than Nate's tips for me, which are dress better, brush your teeth, and hug me more. So, which I'm always happy to do. But hey, we're excited about getting into the semester, about what's going on with this study. So we're going to step into sort of the content that we have for this week, which is, as you'll note, an introduction, so you didn't have to do any upfront reading. Just sort of come at it. So what is a creed? If I ask you what a creed is, what are we talking about? What's your answer to that question? What's a creed? All right, sorry about that. That's what happens when you move around a little bit. It is a statement of belief, a statement of what we believe. Yes. What else? Somebody comes up to you on the street and asks you what a creed is. How do you respond? It's what? It's a band from the late 90s that was good for an album or two. Yeah? I remember Creed. What is a creed? Something that you affirm or ascribe to? Yes, that's true. These are a good start. Let me ask you this. How many creeds are there in Christianity? Four? More than four? Twelve? What else? It depends on what you're talking about. This is true because you can, as we'll talk about in a few moments, lump in confessions with this category, broader category of creeds. So confessions of the faith as well as creeds. So probably more. In this book, a red book called Creeds of the Churches, you will notice that it's fairly thick. And it goes through and talks about the major creeds of the church. And it has 750 pages of creeds that are written in about 8-9 point font. We don't know the number of creeds that there are in a church. This is not exhaustive. And I believe one of the first things that John says in the beginning is, this book is not meant to be exhaustive. There could be thousands of creeds. One of the reasons that there are thousands of creeds is because there's a lot of different kinds of, let's say this the right way, denominations in Christianity. Or confessions of faith. As University Baptist Church, what would be a confession of faith? Because we're Baptists, we're going to talk a little bit about that difference between creed and confession. What is the creed or confession that we would ascribe to as a church? Because this is a fun question to ask, particularly because of the nature of our church. Yes, the Baptist faith and message is a primary document, but which one? Because there's three. You have the 1925, you've got the 2000, and you have the 67, Baptist faith and message, and we ascribe to the middle one, which is exactly right in what you're talking about, which is the 67, without the amendments from 1997, because that's the historic document that we've ascribed to. Now, our participation with other Southern Baptists or Cooperative Baptists is not contingent on us affirming the latest confession of faith for that body. We don't have to officially affirm or confess any of those to be a part of a Southern Baptist Convention. What do we have to do to be a part of the Southern Baptist Convention? Give more than $1 to the cooperative program. That's a whole conversation I'm not going to get into about how that all works. But we've chosen to stay with the from the 60s, the Baptist Faith and Message that was developed by a very good, well, he wasn't just by himself, but it was led by a very good man named Herschel Hobbs, who was a leader in the Southern Baptist during that time. And then later on, they updated that in the year 2000 to a one. And what's interesting is you can actually go to the sbc.net website, which mercifully no longer works with Netscape Navigator because they updated it about 3 years ago. But there's a pastor's joke, but there's a section on there where you can look at the 25, the 67, and the 2000 Baptist Faith and Message side by side, because all the articles are almost all the same, and you can see how that confession has developed. It's a good practice to get into, or just a good maybe something to do, because you can see how doctrine develops over the course of 75 years, depending upon how the theological or political or social winds blow and how those have a response. We don't know how many creeds there are. In the biz, we would say there are probably a little over 1,000 creeds within Christianity. They're affirmed by some Christian body or another, which is really intriguing. What's interesting, though, is there are some significant ones, and then there's some ancillary ones that go along with a lot of things. How have or how do Christians utilize creeds? What have you learned? What have you experienced in your own life? How have or how do Christians utilize creeds? They trust the truth of them. Yes, they become a foundational document for how we practice, something that we study, something that we gather together on Wednesday nights and go through, phrase by phrase. How else do they use them? They distinguish what that group believes. And the group's able to look at it and say, this is what we believe. And they're able to pass that around to people that come to them. Some churches say the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, because there's two different ones there, at the end of every service or regularly within their services. Those are usually more liturgical churches, more mainline maybe churches. How else do they use them? Or how have they used them? To make decisions on leadership, to make decisions on whether a church is a part of a denomination or a group of Christians or not. Creeds have been used to identify false teachers from authentic teachers. Creeds have been used to identify heretics versus those who are lowercase o orthodox. Most of the time when I use the word orthodox, and when I say I want to make a caveat here, I'm almost always referring to the lowercase O orthodox, not the uppercase O orthodox, because who is the uppercase O orthodox? The Eastern Orthodox Church, which is a whole segment of Christianity that we often don't ever come into contact with, but we have actually a really good relationship with as a part of our church. They actually came in here and had a Christmas program a couple weeks ago, one of the local ones. Eastern Orthodoxy, which we're going to talk about, is a massive segment of Christianity. It actually is about six different denominations, if you want to call them that. They're churches, really, within it. But it's a whole sphere of Christianity that we haven't really talked to in the Western Church since 1040, which is when the Great Schism occurred. There's a lot of stuff in there. It's like anytime somebody breaks up, there's always a lot of stuff. This was technically over the use of an iota or an I. In a creed, by the way, which we'll talk about a little bit when we come to that statement. I'm mentioning who is heretic, who is orthodox, who is authentic. They've been used a lot of different ways. We have used them, and we do use them in a lot of different ways. So how do we employ creeds? Well, we sometimes we'll talk about them. Sometimes they're confessions of faith. Sometimes, as they exist today, even in the post-Reformation era in which we live, they are sort of very thoroughly articulated documents of what goes on within Christianity, the boundaries of them. And why do we employ them? Is it helps us clarify beliefs. It helps us articulate what we believe. It helps us talk to other people. And believe it or not, it can be an opportunity for evangelism, talking through a creed with somebody. How do you work with that? I was talking with a friend of mine a couple years ago, who is Muslim, and he and I would get together when we would have tea when I was living in Sugar Land. He was at there's a Turkish Raindrop Center, is what they call it. It's right off of Beltway 8, and it's not airline, but or airport, but it's one of those right there. And it's a beautiful center. He's Turkish and he's Muslim. And we started connecting about some things, while I was doing interfaith ministry partnerships. And we would sit down and we would go through documents of faith, and I would talk to him about the creeds of Christianity. I would really work out of the Apostles' Creed, because for a couple different reasons that we're going to get into a little bit later. And it was a way that I could, as I talked to him about Christianity, express why we believe what we believe about Jesus, why we believe what we believe about God, why we believe what we believe about the Holy Spirit, and why those aren't three specific individual gods, but rather they're one God. So it's a fun way to do that. It's a way that we can employ them. Why do we employ them that way? Well, there's a couple ways, and there's things that we're talking about. Creeds are hopefully good documents that you're able to get into, and we're going to talk a little bit about. So what is a creed? Well, you'll see a couple things that I've got here on the handout that we've got for tonight. And as we keep moving through, they come from the Latin word credere, which is to believe. Really, when you get off the top of it, I was looking at the International Bible Dictionary, International Encyclopedia, and this is their that little line that I have in the second one is really their first sentence. It is a formal or systematic expression of religious faith. It is a formal or systematic expression of religious faith. More specifically, and this is kind of my thing, a creed is a statement of theological truth that delineates central tenets of Christianity agreed upon by a group of Christians. The Roman Catholic Church has a creed. They do. They have a couple of them. They have a number of them, smaller ones, bigger ones, and then they have what they've developed after Vatican II. The Lutheran Church has creeds. A Methodist Church, depending upon which one you're a part of, has creeds that they do. But specifically, it is a statement of theological truths that delineate the central tenets of Christianity agreed upon by a group of Christians. Often it is the boundaries there are denominational. One of the things that's been going on in religious Christian life in the United States is the Episcopal Church of America is having some theological challenges within their denomination, and groups of them have broken off and have formed Anglican churches. Anglican and Episcopal are all similar churches to the Church of England, which is kind of the mothership of them all. And frankly, if you're in England, they don't call you an Episcopalian, they call you an Anglican. The Queen Mother is a Anglican, and she's the head of the Church of England, and where she sits. They, as they this Anglican group break off, have developed their own creed. And they have their own specific set of things that they go by. But yet the Episcopalians have their standing one that they've had, which you can go and you can find and you can look up and so forth. So this spring semester, we're going to be focusing on the Apostles' Creed. We're going to be talking about a document that is so aged and is so ancient that it goes back to the very beginnings of Christianity. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that all happened as well. With that. So there, we do already mention that when we talked about how many creeds are there, a couple people started naming off a couple of the creeds that they're aware of, which include the Apostles' Creed. We believe that the Apostles' Creed formally comes about in about 390. And there's a whole conversation about how that came about. We're going to dip our toe into that tonight. But there is a large group of large group of specialized study in the development of creedal formula within the earliest Christianity. It's riveting stuff. And there's some really interesting developments that are going on with that. Well, one of the first ones is the Apostles' Creed. I would posit that it has a very loose articulation in around the late 200s to about 250, by late 200s to 250. That should be 250 to the late 200s. But the idea there is, this is really during the time of Tertullian and his ministry. This is during the time of Hippolytus. This is the time, Irenaeus has already come and gone by this point. This is the development of a lot of the basic tenets of Christianity. And you find within those documents, some of those writers, you'll start finding some of the language that we see that's being tossed around, that's being toyed with, that's being messed with, that's being articulated, that goes through all of this. So we have the Apostles' Creed that we'll see here in a few moments, really comes together in about 390, probably penned by Ambrose of Milan during that time. Also, we have the Creed of Nicaea, or the Nicene Creed, which follows the Council of Nicaea. Now, one of the things that we do want to mention is that whenever we have, there's several major ecumenical councils, that's what they're called. They begin with the Council of Nicaea that began in around the really early part, the first quarter of the 300s, by a guy named Constantine, who brought Christianity to the Roman Empire for the purposes of clarifying what it is to be a Christian, for the purposes of clarifying the beliefs of Christianity. Out of that council, the Council of Nicaea, which began in 323, the Nicene Creed is one of the documents that's published, but then there's also probably about 50 canons or different things that are published alongside of that. So Nicene Creed is one of them. Another one is the Constantinopolitan Creed, which comes around in 381. Again, following a major ecumenical council, they published a creed as well as some canons. But then you have the Athanasian Creed, or the Cucini Vault, or everyone's everyone ask is another way to put that, which comes about in 440. This is after a fellow named Athanasius was on the earth. Athanasius was also known as the Black Monk. He was an African monk within the western part of the church that brought a lot of theological clarity, particularly to the idea of the incarnation, Christology, which was all the rage at the time, doing lots of work against some heretics who had a very significant life. He probably didn't pull together the bulk of the Athanasian Creed, but somebody came along a little bit after his life and did that, which is what we can expect. A couple things also that we'll see throughout. I've got the rest of these, the notes that are here. Creeds develop at a time, and it's really interesting. Imagine placing yourself here in the 4th century. And you're in a markedly different construct than we exist today. It's so foreign to what we understand. You don't have grocery stores. You don't have cars. You don't have significant roads. You don't have houses that would be able to last, major storms and so forth. Creeds develop at a time where there's not an educational system, where illiteracy is very high. And they develop primarily in oral cultures. And they become devices to help solidify orthodox or authentic teaching of Christianity amid rising heresies and false teaching. Creeds are really developed, just like the councils are developed, in response to heretics and false teachers that are proliferating within Christianity. And the different, what's interesting is if you really start to get to understand and begin looking and begin reading and begin tearing back the pages on all the stuff that's going on, there are specific phrases within creeds that are appealing to specific groups. One group, for instance, was Marcion of Sinope. Marcion was a bishop, and he would have been what I called the first megachurch pastor in Christianity because he had thousands upon thousands of followers in his parish. And he was a great speaker. He was very good looking, too, apparently. And he just naturally developed. He's one of those people, a very charismatic leader. And he took upon himself to formalize a text of Scripture. And he did this by eliminating the Old Testament, cutting out parts of the New Testament, and relying on only the Pauline letters and the Gospel of Luke. And the thing that happens with Marcion is there has to be a specific response to him that develops. And Irenaeus is one of those people that responds, and Hippolytus also responds, as well as Justin Martyr to a degree, though Justin's task is a little more philosophical. But we see that these develop during that time, particularly in combating high illiteracy. So if you're dealing with an oral culture, now a lot of us don't get a lot, it's hard for me to understand that as well. But if you go and you do a mission trip sometime, and you go to a country that still deals with high illiteracy, because they do exist in the world, or you're going into a culture that is very different from where we are, particularly in how they speak a language, one of the things, the devices that we can use is we do something called oral Bible storytelling, and we tell the stories of faith. And the people there, the people that we encounter, they go and they learn those stories, and they're able to pick up on short little phrases and keep them going. That's one of the things that happens with the creed. Now, what's interesting to do is to take a book like Leif's book, Creeds of the Churches, and you begin talking about some of these initial creeds, and they only take up like a quarter of or half of this little tiny page. And then the next one takes up a little bit more. Then the next one takes up the rest of the page. And the one after that takes up a page and a half. And the one after that takes up 4 pages. And the next thing you know, you're into 10-page creeds. Because as people become more educated, they get more access to book technology. They can carry these things around with them. They can write them down. But when you're in an illiterate culture that relies on oral storytelling, you have to keep things shorter. But people can still memorize. Why did we choose, back in the 1920s, why did we choose phone numbers that were only 7 digits? Does anybody know? Because they did a test. This is, again, this is the time where you're still pulling out pins and putting them in switches and all that. They did a test of the vast majority of Americans. How many digits can you hold in your mind at one certain time related to somebody? They tried five. Most people got five. Well, they said, well, that only leaves us this many computational possibilities for phone numbers. Well, then they tried six, and they tried seven. They tried to do eight, and too many people forgot eight. They tried to do 10, and nobody could remember 10, even though we do today because we have area codes. But what happened was we decided on seven-digit telephone numbers because that's the most numbers the average American could hold in their head related to a person that they knew. So, for instance, my phone number growing up was 879-4574. And that was the number that I had growing up in Maryland. I remember it because I also remember the address of my house, 1401 Tavistock Court, because I can hold all that stuff in my mind. That's oral tradition. That's oral storytelling that I can remember. And I can hold a certain number of things. Now, I can also remember the time when it came in Maryland where we had to go from one area code, which, by the way, begins a conversation with Mom, what's an area code, to two area codes for the state of Maryland. We went from 303 for the entire state of Maryland to 303 and 410. And our phone number was in the 410, which is okay because 303, the dividing line was in Baltimore County. And I'm told plenty of relationships ended over having to call long distance for across a street because that's how those switches worked. But remember how all that works. It's the exact same thing with creeds. They began remembering how much can people remember about Christianity and keep in their heads. And we're not that much different than them. We just have to use the right muscles in our brains to get them moving again. And that's the way that a lot of that works. So when you look at these creeds and how they developed, you see that this is the beginning of how Christianity also develops as it becomes more, as people become more educated, become more sophisticated. As a result, our theological documents become more sophisticated. So do our creedal statements. So when you see a creed that expands from really about this many lines with the Apostles' Creed to this many lines of the Nicene Creed to this many lines of the Constantinople Creed to this many lines of the Athanasian Creed, that's a development of doctrine within Christianity that matches up with how people understand. So we see that's a natural development. It's not something to be worried about. It's not something to be concerned about and so forth. I saw a hand over here. Nate, yeah. Well, he did, and it was a big issue. And the church, there's a whole line of conversation about this, about how Marcion was dealt with in the mid-second century. And it wasn't an overnight thing. This took decades to deal with. But as soon as he came out with his stuff, now keep in mind, you're quoting a piece of scripture that he might not have had access to, because the scriptures of the New Testament weren't formalized until the 4th century. But there's an existing tradition that's developing in Christianity through the 2nd century and the 3rd century of a group of documents that define what Christianity is. Because what was the Bible, what was the codified Bible of the earliest Christians up until about 250, or about 150 to 175? It was the Old Testament. But then they began developing, because God doesn't drop books out of skies. Don't forget that. God doesn't drop a book out of a sky and say, here, take this and read it. So that's one of the reasons that we know Mormonism is not true. It's one of the reasons that we know Islam has struggles because it is a way of inscripturation. Because God uses natural processes to bring about his will. It's an interesting thing to think about. So there's a long conversation you can get into with Marcion, and a lot of these creeds are developed specifically about that. Let's look at a couple things. I wanted to touch on the development of these creeds. Probably the first Christian creed that exists, probably the one that came about almost within the lifetime of Jesus. One of those basic elements, the basic thing that you can say is this first one that I mentioned. I put that there in Greek, but it's Jesus Christ is Lord. Here it's Kyrios Jesu Christos, or Jesus Christos. Jesus Christ is Lord. This is an apposition. This is an apposition to a statement that was popular in this time, which is Caesar is Lord. So you can't have Caesar for Lord and Jesus for Lord. You have to choose. And there's a whole conversation that goes on about how this all works out. And because Caesar worship cult in the time would require you, if you're a Roman citizen, to go offer sacrifices or a burnt offering or some kind of an offering to Caesar. And when you did it and you held it over the fire and it got burnt up and it went up to praise the Caesar cult, you would say something along the lines of, "Caesar is Lord." And you would go on about your day and everything would be fine. But the challenge is Christianity rightly believes that you can only have one Lord of your life, and that Lord is Jesus Christ. So instead of affirming Caesar is Lord, it is rather Kyrios, Jesus, Christos, Jesus Christ is Lord. And these come from creedal statements that are in the Bible. I have a list there of some really good, of some good ones that develop. You can actually see, and depending upon what version of the Bible you're using, you can see how these are marked out in the text of the New Testament or something. You'll see it in the Old Testament as well. Peter's confession there in Mark 8:29, "You are Christ. You are the Christ." That's one, again, one of those early confessions of faith. Then they begin to develop. We remember the one out of Philippians where Paul talks about it. What's interesting, that 1 Corinthians 15:3 through 7, if you go and you talk to the most progressive scholars, people that don't affirm a lot of the core essentials of Christianity that teach in secular universities but teach Bible courses and so forth, historically, almost all of them still affirm that 1 Corinthians 15:3 through 7 was probably one of the earliest texts of the New Testament that's authentic. We believe that this is one of the most authentic documents or authentic statements from the earliest days of Christianity. So it leads us to a conversation about the authenticity of Christianity. Why does Jesus Christ arise so quickly as a divine figure when this isn't the pattern of any other religion up to this point? There's something probably going on there. And I can go on for quite a long time talking about 1 Corinthians 15:3-7. Philippians 2:6-1 is a Christological hymn, but it was probably a creedal document, some kind of creedal form. Now, they didn't have music that they would have set these to, but they would have had in their times together, as the early Christians did, ways of reciting these. 1 Timothy 6:12-16 is probably a preformed or at least a creedal tradition. I wrote a paper in seminary for my Greek exegesis class on this passage. Paul begins it in 1 Corinthians 6:11 by saying, "But you, O man of faith, flee these things and pursue these things." So he creates this bridging. He's been talking about all these vices that you're supposed to flee, but that you, the man of God, the person after God's own heart, the person seeking after God, is to pursue these things, which are about holiness and faithfulness and righteousness and these right beliefs about God. Go look it up in this week or and see what that has to say. It's amazing how powerful that development is. And this is mid-first century when these are all pretty much together and so forth. I've got a little statement in there in the notes about Baptists are not a creedal people. I will be happy to get into that more on a sort of a side rail at some other point. But I will mention it here that as Baptists, we don't historically affirm creeds, but rather that we're confessional people. Baptists are a confession of faith. That's why we have the Baptist Confessions of Faith, the London Confession, the Second Baptist Helvetic Confession. We have the Baptist Faith and Message, which is a confession of faith. There's a very significant ecclesiological discussion to be had that we don't have time for. But again, I've got some info there, and we can be happy to talk about it at another time. So what is the Apostles' Creed? I'm going to flip over to the back here. I've got some real basic information in here about how we got it, and then I want to get into just sort of touching on it real quick. So what is the Apostles' Creed? Well, it was probably developed out of the old Roman Creed. One of the authors that probably has impacted my life while I was in seminary at a significant level is a guy who lived, I don't know if about 100 years ago would be correct, but right around the mid-century, last century, is a guy named J.N.D. Kelly. And he's written a series of extremely important books. One of them is called Early Christian Doctrines, which was a very significant book for me. But this is Early Christian Creeds. And this is an early printing of it. And in it, I talked about this a little bit on social media today. We owe a debt of faith to scholars like J.N.D. Kelly from last century. And I said it like this: he excavated a mountain of scholarly data to be able to provide us the diamonds that give us hope. And he really does. He sifts through mountains of documents and gives us those gleaming diamonds of hope. And you find them in books like this. They're really powerful in how they can come together and what they do. But J.N.D. Kelly talks a little bit about this old Roman creed that we have. As I mentioned before, the creed was probably drafted by Ambrose of Milan in 390. Ambrose is a really significant figure around this time in Christianity. I'll be happy to talk to him more as we have time. But he probably gathered this creed the same way that a lot of our biblical documents probably came together. He had scraps of information here, scraps of information here. He had correspondence from here and from here and from here. And he began gathering it all together, and probably circa 390, it might have been a little bit before this, it might have been a little bit after this, he pulls together and he writes a letter where he details out the Apostles' Creed. And he delivers it and he said, "This is the Apostles' Creed." And what's interesting is around the creed itself, it becomes a somewhat of a mythic character to what happens there. There's a guy, you'll notice in there, Tyrannius Rufinius, who is writing at the turn of the 5th century, contemporary of Ambrose. And he relates a story about the development of the Apostles' Creed. He says in his work, and you can go look it up at ccel.org or something, he says, "And the apostles and Christ were all together, and then the Spirit came upon them, and they uttered together this creed in, sort of spontaneously. And this is what is affirmed to this day." One of the reasons that they developed creeds is was to help to show our teaching is authentic to what the apostles had, not this heretic over here. You want to talk about how Marcion was discredited? Well, one of the ways that they discredited heretics like Marcion is they said his teaching isn't in line with the apostles because he doesn't have a theological progenitor. He doesn't have a theological father in the apostles. But we do because of this creed. Historically, we can say you probably stretched the issue a little bit, but ultimately, this is how things came about. There are some variations in this document, but we'll be using the most referenced text throughout this. I've got a couple other notes in there, but I want to get through this so we can see how everything else is going. So let's do this. Let's look at what is the Apostles' Creed. So everybody take your piece of paper that you got and flip to that second page, because I can't think of a better way to start a study on the Apostles' Creed than to recite the Apostles' Creed together. So let's begin. You'll notice at the bottom of that page, so when it begins like this, "I believe in God," you can go along with me, "I believe in God the Father, Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only begotten Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost and born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and buried, and he descended into hell. And on the third day, he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of God the Father Almighty. From thence he shall come to judge the quick and the dead. I believe in the Holy Ghost. I believe in the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting." That's the Apostles' Creed. It is a summary statement of some of the basic values of what Christianity has affirmed, I believe, since the biblical times, since the apostles' times. We'll talk over the next several weeks about how some of these things come about. Where we have moments to talk about how the creed developed, we will. But we're going to look biblically. How do we know that these things are true? We're going to look historically. How have they come about and how have they been worked through? And we're going to look devotionally. We're going to look practically. How do we apply these things into our life? And we're going to talk about some of the controversies in there too, because there's some really fun stuff. There's all kinds of statements about the creed that are out there. I'd encourage you guys to look through those. I threw up a little. This is the Greek from the creed in and of itself. It's a pretty concise statement that's packaged together. You can see a lot of the things that come in these words that you see in front of you, the Greek. There are theological papers being done and have been done on just simple words or phrases in the hundreds and in the thousands. This creed has been a significant one. We're going to talk a little bit about that. So that's what we have for tonight. See if I can get to the next slide. I can't. So we're going to have to look at the Greek the whole time. I don't know what happened to my clicker. Here it goes. There we go. All right. Thoughts or questions, and we'll have our pastor come and wrap us out. Any other thoughts or questions? Yes. Yeah, so what do we do with the, and then he descended into hell? How do we understand that? Because in the transmission of the creed, there's been some really interesting conversations about that phrase. How do we understand when Jesus said, and I tell you, this day you will be with me in paradise? Because you got that whole this day part, and that kind of messes with the whole concept of, well, did Jesus descend to hell after he was dead? Because there's a section in 1 Peter chapter 3 that sure makes it seem like that's what happened. How do we understand that? How do we mess with that? You'll get to come that week and learn. I can't give you a straightaway answer. And notice, it's on your schedule. So we'll talk about that one. That's a real fun one on February 28th. So come and be a part of that. I will give you an evasive answer right now. So anything else? Any other thoughts, any questions?
Based on what you just said there, let me add to the confusion. So if Jesus died, is he out of time? I mean, does he step out of time? So when he says this day, it's not in our concept of time.
Was he talking about purgatory? I don't mess with you. No. Yeah, that's a good question. Does when Jesus dies, does he step out of time? Does he move into the divine nature of atemporality, or is he omnitemporal, or is he living in a multiverse, or does he just move outside of any construct of time because time is only simply something that was created? Because in God's understanding, there is no time. And how do we understand if God knows something in 1935 that's going to happen in 2005? Does he intend it, or does he just simply know? These are great questions. And you're going to find out on specific weeks about these, so you get to come back and learn. So, and we can have a conversation offline up here as well as I'm selling my books off to the side. So, any other thoughts, questions? Pastor is here.
Here's a thing I'll hear me about talk loud. Part of the process of studying creeds, I think, is it's good food for thought on a methodology of how
you look at creeds like this and they evolve over time, and in the history of Christianity we love to be slaves to tradition. We don't change or evolve easily at all, and I've had conversations with people that really ascribe to much more ancient varieties of Christianity at times, and they want to know why we would ascribe to a branch of Christianity that is relatively more modern. And I think of it in the same way I do any other field of study, whether the field of study is medicine, whether it's engineering, whether it's philosophy, whether it's literature. There's a sense in which being nostalgic about how we used to practice medicine 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago is interesting. It's food for thought. We can look at pictures and watch documentaries. But when I go to have surgery today, I want the very best of what 2,000 plus years of human ingenuity and investigation and research has been able to uncover, practiced whenever they take my appendix out or whenever they do bypass surgery on my mom. There's something, we would say the same about economics, about government, we're trying to move forward. And look, in the 3rd century BC, they knew a lot, but they hadn't cornered the market on everything that there is to know about the Bible. You've already heard that the Bible was still in formation, that it wasn't in print, it wasn't available for widespread reading or interpreting. And over the years, the Bible is a living thing. It continues to be made more accessible, translations have gone out, and our understanding of it, even today, continues to be made more robust because of archaeological finds. We find biblical texts that give us a bigger picture of how to interpret them, how to understand them. Our study of ancient languages really is better now than it was in the Reformation days 500 years ago, particularly of Hebrew, maybe not as much of Greek, but when you look at across the history of our confessions and creeds, you see an evolution of thinking. And it doesn't mean that, that we change our mind. It doesn't mean that we go back and renege on some things. One of the reasons why the Apostles' Creed is so engaging is because it just kind of hits the very essential essentials. And even 1,700 years later, with a couple of peculiarities that we mentioned, but for the most part, these are things that are unanimous across the world of Christianity. The Trinity, virgin birth, death and resurrection of Christ, the community of believers. And so it still kind of stands, but then we love to fill in the gaps. You know, Garrett mentioned the three monotheistic faiths. And if you know much about Judaism or about Islam, you know that both of those also have their primary texts, and both of them have their writings of interpretations. In Judaism, the rabbinical interpretations, the Mishnah. In Islam, it's the interpretations of key figures throughout history. And in large part, both in Judaism and in Islam, the interpretations are more well known and more argued over than the original primary texts. It's what separates Islam into its different sects. In the time of Jesus, it's what separated Judaism into its different sects. The Mishnah is read more commonly than the Torah was. The Islamic interpretations are Hadith. Yeah. Much more commonly read and argued and fought over than the Quran happens to be. And so within Christianity, we have these interpretations too. In some cases, they're in the form of creeds. In some cases, they're in the form of confessions of faith, statements of faith. Our own Baptist tradition exemplifies three of them and the way that they shift and change over time. And I think what that does for me is it reminds me that I can be very convinced and very convicted of what I believe today, but I don't have all the answers, and I don't know everything. And my doctrines and my beliefs need to constantly be going through a process of sharpening and honing and questioning, and I shouldn't be afraid to make changes in the things that I believe. Keep in mind that we are, for the most part, Protestants. And the key word in the word Protestant is what? Yeah, protest. Protest. Because there were Christians who were a part of the Catholic Church who, in reading Scripture, came to be convinced that it was being interpreted incorrectly. Even though centuries of creeds stated one thing, the practices, the way that those things were being practiced, suggested that they were being interpreted falsely. And so, it was much bloodshed and yelling and fighting and screaming that enabled Martin Luther and Calvin and others to break away from the Catholic Church, but they protested what they believed to be false teaching, false doctrine, false practice in the church. And that's part of our heritage. The other part of our heritage as Baptists is identifying the practice of baptism that we find to be, not that we find to be heretical or problematic, but that we find to be different from what we see most commonly practiced in the biblical account. And so we're Baptists. That name specifically speaks to the fact that we practice baptism differently than the Catholic Church did. Those are evolutionary processes. For Protestants, they were. For Baptists, they were. And we as a church should be very comfortable saying, these are the things that we hold to as essentials of our faith. These are beliefs that we currently have. But we recognize that within the community of Christians, there's some variance here. We're not scared of gray areas. We're not scared of saying, I don't know when we don't know. But we ought to always study to have a reasoned response, a reasoned answer for believing the things that we believe. And the process of creeds and confessions, I think, is engaging. You could look at it across the whole breadth of thousands of years, or you could just look at it in the last 100 years within our own Baptist system and the confessions of faith we have, and a lot of the arguing and fighting that has entailed with those attempts to evolve, or in some cases, attempts to move backwards, which is what some people would say
the most recent Baptist confession of faith was trying to do. And so we're slaves to tradition in a lot of ways, and in religion maybe more than anything else. But we want to continue speaking about our faith in ways that answer the questions that the lost world today is asking. And sometimes that means talking about our faith in different ways. Sometimes it means giving different answers. You know, the issue of the problem of evil and suffering, which we talk about in here through numerous semesters, is a huge pitfall for people in coming to believe in God. 1,000 years ago, that might not have been the case. It probably wasn't the case, because people weren't aware of every single, you know, murder and war and natural disaster that happened in every corner of the earth. Today, we know all of the horrible things that happen. And that brings us back around to questioning God because of the existence of such great evil and suffering in the world. We have to be constantly thinking about our faith and how it speaks to the issues that are prominent in our day. That's the church's job. And we can't present our faith to our community in our time if we only insist on ever being slaves to creeds and confessions that are centuries old, that were how the church in those days communicated its faith to their challenges and their problems. The Bible for us remains the foundation. The primary text remains our sole authority. And these confessions and creeds help us communicate our beliefs, but they are shifting. In fact, one of the variances in creeds and confessions that I'd always thought of, creeds are usually presented as litmus tests that are authoritative over centuries, whereas confessions of faith are statements of inclusion. In other words, if you don't believe everything in this creed, you can't be a part of us. If you don't believe everything in this confession, you know, this is just telling you what we believe. And if you don't believe them, then... And that may be a little bit more fuzzy, but confessions seem to be recycled and evolved much more common, whereas creeds can really stand the test of time over centuries. And that's not a bad thing, unless, like people of other monotheistic faiths, we take those creeds and elevate them above the Bible itself and constantly working to make sure our interpretations of it are correct. So many different creeds and confessions in their existence illustrate to us that so many Christians believe the Bible, but we don't all interpret it exactly the same way. And I'm grateful that our salvation is by faith, not by correct interpretation on every nuance of the Bible. So think about that as methodology. It's part of the reason why we at UBC value diversity even within our theology. And that doesn't mean that diversity is endless. There are essentials that we believe are key to being Christian. And there are not essentials, but close to the middle, that are things that we choose to practice because we believe that they are best practices, or there are cultural practices. And then there are peripheral things that we'll talk about. And Garrett and I have reasons for what we believe, and we encourage you to have those too. But they are not criterias for being a part of our community of faith, or do we think they're criteria for you being a Christian. They're things that we wrestle with and struggle with. And so that's a core value, that we value the diversity within our community. And I want you to understand we do that for many, many reasons, not least of which is looking at how our thinking has evolved over 2,000 years of people following God post the time of Christ, not even including, you know, 2,000 years of recorded Old Testament history prior to that. And so it's a very well thought out reasoning, at least we believe. So that's my so what, a methodological thoughts. But we'll get into theology next week. I'm going to lean on Garrett a lot the first few weeks because my 7th grade son Sam has basketball games on Wednesday nights till about mid-February. And then, but we'll be tag teaming as often as not. So thank you guys for coming in. You want to add anything else or recap?
Other than I will just say that next week, if you look in your syllabus, we're going to be talking about I Believe in God the Father Almighty. And chapters 1 through 3 in this wonderful little book that you can come right over here and buy for $5. So talk to you next week.